Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for your continued support. And remember, click the subscribe button, everybody. This is a special episode because born the mothership is Armin Shimmerman. You know him as Quark on Star Trek Deep Space Nine. In this episode, we discuss Star Trek Lower Decks and his second book in the Illyria series, A Sea of Troubles. Now prepare to go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Shimmerman. Thank you so much for coming to the Traversing the Stars podcast.
My pleasure to be here, Jeff.
You're an honor to speak with, sir. I mentioned it off air, but it's true. The interview I had with you a couple of years back was probably my favorite interview I've ever done. So thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm going to start off with a question about Star Trek. So you have recently appeared again as Quark on Star Trek Lower Decks, which was a great episode. How did it feel to inhabit the character again, and how easy was it to find him once more?
Well, I'll take the second question first. It was enormously easy to find him. Those inroads that Quark made into me have never really disappeared. And it was just a matter of, once I put the teeth in, everything came back, rushing back. The joy that he taught me was there, and we had a great time doing Lower Decks. It was terrific to inhabit the character again. He was a delicious character. I had a wonderful time doing him for the 7 years that I was on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and I've sort of missed him a little, but when I'm at conventions, I'm sort of role-playing Quark a little, so he hasn't been totally divorced from me for 20 years or more.
So when you're doing the voice, you still had to have the teeth in, and were they your teeth, or did they make teeth for you to do it?
Great question. The irony is, in the last couple of weeks before we stopped shooting Deep Space Nine, for some reason, the teeth disappeared out of my trailer. I don't know if they were lost or whether someone came in and took them and went on eBay somewhere, but they made me a new set, which I didn't wear for years and years and years. It's a biological fact that the teeth in your mouth shift around as years go by. And so a couple years back, I tried to put the old teeth into my mouth and found that they didn't fit. So I knew that I was going to appear in England in makeup and in costume. And I asked my niece, Natasha, to make me a new set. She's a special effects artist, and she made me a new set. So I had Natasha's teeth, but unfortunately, Natasha's teeth were made slightly different than Michael Westmore's teeth, and therefore the sound was a little bit different to my ear anyway than what I normally sounded like, because they sat in my mouth differently.
That's crazy. I never would have even thought about something like that.
Neither would I. And somewhere along the line, if I ever were to do Quark on camera again, I would probably have to have them remade the way Michael made them.
So one interesting thing is that also in the episode is Nana Visitor as Kara. Was she also doing the voice acting along with you, or were you guys separate booths?
Excellent question. No, the situation in voiceovers, especially for things like that, we go into a booth separately and we perform. People have asked me, well, was it hard not having Nana there? And the answer is, just as Quark was familiar to me, so was Nana's performance of Major Kira. And so even though she wasn't there, I could sort of surmise and guess what she was going to do. And I see her enough times, I just had dinner with her the other day, in fact, that her voice is very, very familiar to me.
Now, I'm sure you're gonna get this question all the time, and I'm sure it's unavoidable, but because of the appearance that you did in Lower Decks, and because of Picard and its reunion, has there been whispers of the Deep Space Nine reunion, and what do you think that would look like if it did happen?
Well, the hard truth is there are no whispers about a Deep Space Nine reunion. Secondly, that would be a little bit difficult as we've lost Renee, who was a major integral part of that. And then, of course, you would have a major question for a producer anyway, which is, which of the Daxes would you use?
That's true.
And certainly if you chose one, you couldn't have them both. Maybe you could, maybe you could. You chose one, you would certainly hurt the feelings of the other. That doesn't preclude the Deep Space Nine crew from getting back. And of course, Jake is no longer a 14 year old boy. He's a man in his 40s. So it would be slightly difficult to bring us all back.
Would you support the idea of it?
I would definitely support the idea. In that appearance that I was mentioning before where I had to wear the teeth, and I misquoted my niece's name. Natasha is my niece, but it wasn't Natasha who did it. It was Harmony. When I put the makeup on, Ira Bear was there at that convention, as was I, of course, and my wife was there, and my makeup artist, Karen Westerfield, was there. And we were gobsmacked at how much like Quark of 20, 25 years ago I looked. It was astounding. I felt like I'd been in a time machine and gone back 25 years because I looked identical to what I had before, mainly because of the expertise of Karen Westerfield who did it. And because we had stolen, for want of a better word, we had stolen some of the pieces that were originally used on the show and we used them again in England. So there I was looking exactly the same. Yes, I would be tickled beyond belief to put that makeup back on and inhabit Quark's skin again.
See, I think I speak for many Trekkers or Trekkies, however you want to call them, and say that of all the Star Trek, Deep Space Nine was my favorite, and I would love to see the characters back on the big screen once more.
Well, thank you. It's been 20 years. Of course, we've also lost Aaron Eisenberg, who was a major component of our team. We would love to see it as well, but none of us are holding our breath, Jeff.
I totally understand that, but I think your fans may be. So not only did you do one of, like I said, I think the best Star Trek iteration, but you're also a phenomenal author, and you wrote two wonderful books based on the series.
I'm just going to correct you. I know what you're about to say, and you're absolutely right. But I've actually written 6 books, but okay.
Yeah, I was going to, I'm in the Illyria series.
That's right.
Betrayal of Angels and A Sea of Troubles. And both books were absolutely phenomenal. They focus on, for the listeners who may or may not know, they focus on characters John Dee and William Shakespeare. So what inspired the creation of this series? And was the plan always to have them as 3 books, or were they supposed to be one big book?
Thank you, Jeff. Excellent question. So in the books I wrote before the Illyria series, which is called the Merchant Prince series, the main character there was also Dr. John Dee. That historical character was introduced to me by my co-writer on the first Merchant Prince book, Michael Scott. And as I was writing the Merchant Prince books, which was mostly, I made John Dee into Quark mostly, he was mostly Quark. But I felt obliged to give Dr. John Dee his due. And I swore to myself that if I ever wrote another trilogy, that I would try to recreate the John Dee of history and not one that of Star Trek. And so the inspiration was originally Michael Scott, who introduced me to that character. He also, after the Merchant Prince series was written, we met once for lunch. And he suggested a series of novels where John Dee and William Shakespeare went on adventures and ended up meeting characters from the 37 plays that Shakespeare wrote. Because it took me 20 years to write the Illyria series, I don't see this idea of me visiting all of the Shakespearean plays ever happening. But to your question, originally, it was meant to be one book. However, when I sold Jumpmaster Press the book, they asked me after the contract was sealed, how many words do you have? And when I told them how many that book was, which was quite a few, they said, you don't have one book, you have 3 books. And then they asked me to write 3 books. But I knew that each book needed to have a cliffhanger, like any good TV show does. And so I had to incorporate 2 cliffhangers into the 3 books, which meant that I had to rewrite the story at the beginning of the second book and the third book in order to deal with the cliffhanger that I'd written into the previous books. And that took up a great deal of writing space. And so the books radically changed, actually, from my original concept. The original manuscript that I submitted to Jumpmaster Press changed radically as I dealt with the cliffhangers. And a lot of people are a little bit miffed that the story doesn't end at the end of book one or the end of book two. But now that the third book is coming out on January the 24th, they'll be able to read the full series and not be upset about the fact that it doesn't have an ending.
I will say, having loved, like I said, I love the first two books. The second book, I must admit, yeah, I was like, holy, you can't end a book like that. Jesus Christ. I was like, I mean, luckily, you know, the third book is coming, but that's a hell of a cliffhanger ending right there.
As it was meant to be. For those who haven't read the second book, I know I'm giving away something here, but I think it's delicious to mention. I kill off the main character, John Dee.
Wait, oh, he's definitely dead?
That I won't answer.
Oh, like what stuck in my head almost immediately is that I called it like an Empire Strikes Back feeling in the second book where everything goes wrong for the heroes throughout that book in the series. Like, and then it ends on that cliffhanger, sort of like a little Han Solo-ish. I was like, I sat there going, how the hell are you going to figure out how to get him out of this situation? You have a book to write, goddamn, a third one.
Yeah, I thought it was a good way to, I thought it was a tremendous cliffhanger, and it does upset people. But there is a third book.
I will say it upsets people, I think, in the best possible way, which is, you know, you got the reader, you know, you sold them on the story when they can be that annoyed that something bad had happened at a cliffhanger.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I can only attribute it, as you did just now, to good writing,
I really do think it's an exceptional writing. I mean, especially your handling of the two protagonists, Shakespeare and Dee. And because you give Shakespeare a Shakespearean kind of speech pattern, a little bit of an extra elevated quality to it. Dee has an extra elevated quality to him. It really is top writing, in my opinion. And I mean legit, because I enjoyed both immensely.
Thank you. As some people may know, other people wouldn't know. Besides being an actor, I am a Shakespearean scholar. So I've been involved with Shakespeare since high school, really, and I'm a little past high school now. That language is second nature to me. I also teach an approach to Shakespeare through the study of rhetoric. So I'm using rhetorical devices and rhetorical language for the character's dialogue. So it comes natural to me. And I wanted to do that. If I'm going to write about a period, it seems to me it's incumbent upon me to write in a way that those people perhaps thought. I'm not sure that they spoke that way, but I'm quite sure that the more educated people thought that way, or at least were trained to think that way. That's what they studied in school. So I really get disappointed with historical novels of that period when I see words that weren't even around during those times. And I was scrupulous about making sure that every word I used is from that period. Although I must admit, there's a couple words in the first book that aren't from that period. My research wasn't sufficient enough. And knowledgeable people have told me that some of the words are not true to the period. For instance, grog. I used grog in the first novel, which is a drink sailors used to drink. And I just assumed it was an Elizabethan beverage as well. I come to find out that there was no grog until about 100 years after my period. So I apologize for that, but there are very few of those. Everything else, it's not only, I think, a very good tale, but it's also, and this should not put anybody off, it's also a very good history lesson. You are learning about the times in a way perhaps you weren't aware of them. Everyone thinks of Elizabethan England as merry old England. And unfortunately, historically, it wasn't so merry for a lot of people.
Well, the interesting thing too, a lot of the story takes place in Illyria. And I know there is an historical version of that. There's also a Shakespearean one. Is it closer to Shakespeare or the historical?
It's closer to the Shakespearean one. The historical one, I believe, if I have it right, is close to Turkey. I think that's historically where Illyria was originally a millennia ago. But Shakespeare writes about Illyria as an island somewhere. We don't know where Illyria is in Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. But I make it very specific. I chose the island of Jersey to be my role model for Illyria, and because I'm from New Jersey, and not from Jersey, but from New Jersey, so I make it. I use some of the descriptions are inspired by the island of Jersey, but I wanted to make it both historical and fantastical at the same time.
Now, one interesting thing about the Shakespeare that you're writing about is that there wasn't a lot known about Shakespeare during this time period. Also, his age is like 16 or 17. So when you're thinking about writing him, how did you determine what pre-Shakespeare that we understand or know him as would have sounded like?
Very good question. So because he's young, 16 or 17, as you said, one of the things I tried to do was to make him less rhetorical. At the time that he's speaking more in the vernacular of the times and not using rhetorical devices, which was the hallmark of a good writer at the times. As he gets older, I try to start to infuse rhetoric, which is what John Dee is teaching him, into his dialogue as well. That's one of the ways I made it. And also just simply my own awareness of how people mature as they get older.
The impact on how Shakespeare is maturing is credited to either Dee, is it his isolation on Illyria, or is it interacting with the Count?
I think it's a combination of all those things. He is learning from his experiences, we all do. Dee is his teacher, his mentor, his employer, but he is fascinated with Count Orsino, and he's learning courtly ways because he's in the court of Orsino, and that is teaching him something as well. And he's getting older. He's having relationships with women and men for that matter. And he's learning about politics. He's learning about world affairs. He's gone from being a rather simple, closed off country boy to cosmopolitan.
Do you think, is the impact greater on Shakespeare, Dee's impact on Shakespeare, or is Shakespeare's impact just as big on Dee?
I think I think the impact is greater on Shakespeare. I think Shakespeare is learning more than Dee is. Dee is trying to find out the truth of the Count's loyalty, but it's a fault of mine that Dee hasn't learned as much from Shakespeare as Shakespeare has learned from him. I think that's where my mind was focused. And in the best of all possible worlds, if I could go back and rewrite the novels, I would inject more of that Dee was learning from Shakespeare as well. Thank you for that. It's really something, should I ever write another novel about this sort of thing, I would think about that a great deal.
I think most all of us would love to have a continuation of these characters because I think they do complement each other so well. And especially it feels like there's a softening in Dee as well in dealing with Shakespeare. And there's a bond there that's strengthening. I mean, without giving too much away, something bad happens to Shakespeare where he's badly injured. And it feels like Dee is seriously feeling the impact of that as well. I feel like there's a softening of him due to Shakespeare.
There is that. He grows more tender towards Shakespeare because of the things that are happening to Shakespeare. And also he feels a great responsibility in the fact that he's yanked this teenage boy out of his milieu and placed him in a strange place and left him for that matter. And he feels a little guilty about that, absolutely. And he grows closer to Shakespeare in the way, and this has always been the role model, in the way that Watson grows closer, or Holmes grows closer to Watson because of their affinity and their relationship.
How much of the relationship is a factor that, I mean, Dee needs Shakespeare. He wants that perfect memory that Shakespeare has to record the details. Is Shakespeare cared for because he's a fantastic tool, or because he's an actual human that he finds compassion in?
I think he starts out as a tool. I think that's the primary reason. He's amused by Shakespeare's antics. He's an actor after all. But gradually, I think there's a fondness for him, a father-son relationship that grows as the books progress.
So one aspect of the book is that I think that's different than the first novel is that there's a definite sense of time in this one. Dee has 6 months to solve, so there's definitely a sense of impending doom that's in this novel. So how impactful is this deadline to Dee psychologically?
I think it's very important. I think it weighs upon him heavily. I don't want to give away too many details, but we know that at the end of 6 months, he's in dire circumstances if he doesn't succeed at this mission that's been imposed upon him. So he feels that very heavily. I don't think Shakespeare is aware of it and sympathizes, but I don't think he's as heavily impacted as Dee is. Dee is concerned not only about himself, but about his family, about his reputation, about what history will make of him. Frightened, in fact, that his family will never hear from him again.
Now, one thing that's kind of interesting is that Dee's mission is to determine the traitors in Illyria of basically those who are following the Catholicism instead of the Protestant faith. Now, let's say, for instance, hypothetically, if Dee came to the island and said, you know, and discovered there is no traitors on this island, there, you know, Count Orsino and Countess Dion are honest, you know, Protestants, and he went back to Walsingham and said, everything's good. Would Walsingham buy that as a response?
No, because Walsingham has his suspicions that Illyria is a way station for Catholic invasion into England. There were laws passed at that time to keep not so much Catholics, but certainly Catholic religious people out of England. They were outlawed, and there was great fear that there would be a Catholic wave of protesters that would assassinate the Queen. In fact, historically, there were several attempts made by Catholics who did it, including, if you've read the novel, and you find out, including one of Shakespeare's relatives actually did try to murder the Queen. I think Walsingham would not have trusted Dee if Dee had come back and said, no, there's nothing there, because he was a spy master. He had spies all over Europe, and he was aware this was happening. He had caught people in England. He knew they were coming from Europe. He just was trying to figure out where they were coming from. And all of his spider sense told him that that perhaps they were coming from Illyria.
So for Dee, how much is Dee's search one of truth, and how much of it is placating Walsingham to get back home?
I think it's both. I think the primary reason is to find the truth. The sooner he finds out the truth, the sooner he can go back home and avoid the penalties that have been imposed upon him if he doesn't succeed. But that's often the way at this time. It was important to find the truth, of course, but it was also important to give the authorities what they wanted, good, bad, and indifferent. And in this case, they both coincide. The truth and Walsingham's suspicions were the same. He just wanted to find out who was responsible, and Walsingham has his suspicions of who it is.
I think one of the most fascinating parts of the second novel has to do with the Star Chamber, which was absolutely a wonderfully written section of this book.
Thank you.
And I'm curious about, was the Star Chamber section, does it exist because of what happens in the cliffhanger of book one, in other words, you had to figure out how to get him back to the island?
That's exactly right. You're absolutely right. The Star Chamber section of the book was never in the original idea, never, ever. But because of the cliffhanger of book one, I was forced into thinking about, well, what happens if he does what he does? And the Star Chamber section and being arrested, I thought was a good way to deal with that. Star Chamber was a horrible situation. They called it a court of law, but it really wasn't. It was just a group of noblemen who decided one way or another the justice of a person's actions, and oftentimes they were wrong, and there were no laws followed. It wasn't, you know, where you could put up the law, but the justices didn't care. They didn't care. They were only looking at the character of the man on trial.
I think one interesting thing is that Walsingham is there at the trial, the Star Chamber, and obviously for those who read the first book, Dee's like his man. He's the one. Walsingham's the one who sends Dee on the mission to begin with. Why is Walsingham seemingly indifferent to his plight, Dee's plight, during the Star Chamber?
Because to give something away, which is important in this discussion, is that he feels Dee has abandoned the mission that he was told that he had to do, and therefore is very angry with Dee for having come back. And good, bad, or indifferent, he's going to get his revenge for one of his spies, and he had many, and one of his spies disobeying the orders.
Is there no compassion for Jane's situation back home for Dee in the mind of Walsingham?
None. No.
That sucks for Dee, because Jane wasn't, for those who don't know, she's just about to have a second child. And she's a fantastic character. But you can understand where Dee is coming from, having to rush home to be in this situation. And they're also having these financial dire straits.
It's all historically true. Historically true. And ironically, Dee's first child, Arthur, Walsingham is the godfather to Arthur. But the people of that time had different mindsets than we do. Maybe not. Maybe people of our time have the same mindset.
But it sounds interesting to have a character like Walsingham be so indifferent to the situation where he kind of is causing Dee's difficulties because he's not home. Jane's having those difficulties at home. There's that the person in the house, I can't remember the gentleman's name, who she's also kind of terrified of as well. Go ahead.
That's Edward Kelly, who is, again, a historical figure who did indeed live in Dee's home, who Jane Dee was terrified of. Absolutely. All historically correct.
So why, you know, how can he be so indifferent to Dee's situation, considering that he's causing the problem?
Because Walsingham was first, second, third, and fourth the Queen's foreign ambassador, and the only he and Burleigh, their sole purpose they felt in life was to protect not only the Queen but the Queen's government, and anything else was tangential to their way of life. I'm sure they had tender feelings towards people and certainly to their families. But as far as Dee's just one of his spies, and he has to be treated as one of his spies. And if one of his spies doesn't do what Walsingham wants him to do, then there's going to be a reaction, and not a good one.
There's one scene missing from the second book that I'm fascinated by. Dee is found guilty, without ruining too much, is found guilty in the Star Chamber, and he's going to be tossed into prison. He winds up in Illyria. So there's obviously a moment where he's set free and brought back. Was it Walsingham who finally does it? And what was that conversation probably like?
Yes and no. I do write about that. And you're right. It could have been more explicated. The Queen, historically, and in my book, favors Dee. And of course, the Queen is Walsingham's boss. And so the Queen suggests, or between Walsingham and the Queen, they come up with a compromise that Dee will be let out of prison, but he's only given so much time, as we've alluded to complete his mission. But that is the Queen interposing herself into the Star Chamber, which historically she could do at any time. If the Star Chamber could decide on a verdict, but if the Queen didn't like the verdict, or for that matter, James the King after Elizabeth, then the verdict was put aside and the royalty got their way.
Now, I think one thing that's fascinating with Dee as well is that his goal is to suss out the bad Catholics in Illyria. Now, if I understand the story...
Bad is certainly a word you could use, but I
perspective.
Disloyal Catholics.
Disloyal.
Because there were many loyal Catholics. But we're looking for disloyal Catholics.
Disloyal ones. All right. Well, my apologies. I also didn't want to think that saying Catholics are all inherent we've had. But within the story, D, in my understanding of the story, is correct as well, was at one point a Catholic himself. And
yes.
And a very strong adherent to that Catholicism.
Yes.
Is this kind of a comeuppance that he's now kind of acting against those who he was a loyal part of, maybe just, you know, a certain amount of time earlier?
I don't know if it's a comeuppance. It's a political fact. We only have to look at our own times to see that happen. There are many people let's look at your, this is airing tomorrow, so I can say this. There are many people who were anti-abortion for great periods of time, but in order to get elected, they'd run and they won their primaries on an anti-abortion platform. But in order to convince the other people who aren't necessarily conservatives, they moderate their opinion to say, oh, well, some things can be allowed. So that's exactly what happens to Dee when he was working in a Catholic government, when Queen Mary, who was a Catholic, was the queen. Then he was a Catholic and he espoused Catholic ideals and was a chaplain to an archbishop. But when the government changed and the government went from being Catholic to Protestant, then he too changed in order to keep his profession going, to keep his livelihood going. And we don't know, historically, we don't know what was the true frame of reference for Dee. And in fact, one of the great questions that has puzzled scholars for years and years and years and years, we don't know the actual preference of Shakespeare's either. Shakespeare comes from a Catholic family, but certainly to work for the queen and to be part of her livery, she was part of the queen's men, they wouldn't allow a Catholic to be a part of that. So was he a secret Catholic? Was he practicing Protestant? No one knows.
Is Dee secretly still a Catholic? Because he seems very much a concerned faith.
I think at this point in time, he is a committed Protestant. His wife, Jane, is certainly a committed Protestant. But he, having been a Catholic, I think he has some tenderness for the Catholic policies and doctrines because he once espoused them. Mm. So he's not totally against them, but he's done the politic thing and converted to Protestantism in order to be favorable in Elizabeth's court.
So I think one thing that's very kind of interesting in the story, not only is that Dee, he is viewed as a heretic in several parts of the story. The Star Chamber is one. The ending is a second situation where he's viewed as a heretic. He's viewed as someone who may or may not be a Satanist by some, a dark magician or whatever, sorcerer by some. Early, how much did Dee like the reputation before this, and how much is he paying the price for the reputation?
Well, he historically was considered a Satanist. He was historically considered to be a worker of magic and therefore of evil deeds. But on the other hand, the queen actually historically employed him sometimes to do horoscopes and to help with mystical things. She was very much interested in mystical things. So his reputation, the more that he became, as is often called, the queen's conjurer, the more his reputation grew. But on the adverse side, the more he did that, people thought he was a black musician and needed to be eradicated. His house, if I have this correctly, and I think I do, his house was three times ransacked by the mob because they were trying to get at him for what they thought he was doing. But from my studies, he doesn't seem to have ever been interested in black magic. He was very interested in white magic, which in other words, he was looking for God the whole time. He wasn't looking for the devil. He was looking for God. But people didn't understand the difference.
I think one interesting thing that he was being punished for or accused of in the Star Chamber is that he was being accused of trying to speak to angels.
That's right.
Now, as someone who's a Protestant or Catholic, you believe in, they believe in God, you kind of believe in angels. What is the issue then with trying to speak to angels, which I think isn't that everyone does when they're praying anyway?
Yeah, the problem is, good Christians believe that, and Jews for that matter, I imagine Muslims do as well, believe that angels exist. The problem was, Dee was actively trying to communicate with angels, and a lot of people didn't like the methods he used to do that. Furthermore, a lot of people found it sacrilegious to even try to attempt communications with angels, and sort of treading on heaven's doorstep, which a lot of people found they just didn't like it at all. So it promoted his career. It made him a valuable creature for Elizabeth, but it also made him liable for a lot of attacks.
And another part that's kind of interesting about that is that Dee does actually believe he is talking to angels. I think he seemed to deny it during the Star Chamber, but in book one, he's definitely thinking he's talking to angels. So once again, how much is he a hypocrite for speaking against it, but at the same time actively trying?
He is a hypocrite if he denies his belief that he's been talking to angels. I mean, he's left us many books about those conversations. He actually created a dictionary of language that he thought angels used. It's called the Enochian Dictionary. And he believed that for the entirety of his life. The problem is, he didn't actually speak to them. He had an interpreter, Edward Kelly, who I mentioned before, and there were others as well. And those men were probably less than forthright or honorable or believable. Dee believed them, but one history has sort of suggested that they were all scoundrels and they were taking advantage of Dee's largesse.
So Edward was translating. So how was that working with the Enochian language or Enochian language? Was Dee hearing things and then asking what it was hearing, or was Edward just lying about what it was saying?
They're called screers. Edward Kelly was a screer, and what he would do was stare into a polished stone after a period of time and go into a trance, and he would, like a seance, very much like a seance, he would hear things, perhaps even speak things, and would be having a conversation with various angels. And then either he said things out loud that Dee took down in his journals, or Dee quizzed him after the seance was over and got his information from Edward Kelly and the others after the seance was over. So that's how he did it. Dee himself, as far as I know, now granted, there's an incident in book one where I sort of fudge that a little. Actually, there's also one in book two, I think, also. That's an author's privilege that I can smudge history a little. But historically, Dee didn't actually hear anything. He just watched. He was a witness to what Kelly was doing.
So, I mean, it was Dee, the real Dee, kind of gullible? And the book Dee doesn't seem to have that aspect. It doesn't seem like he's gullible.
Yeah, the real Dee probably was gullible in this area. He was trusting that his screers were legitimate. And that real Dee is to be faulted for that, and history has faulted him for it. They think of him as a fool for having listened to this. Again, the author's privilege, I didn't want to necessarily dwell on that. I wanted to make Dee as honorable as he could be, but still have foibles, still have character traits that are less than perfect.
Now, I think another interesting aspect of the book, going into the same concept of faith and struggle, is Shakespeare. Shakespeare's having a true existential crisis. In the book, it feels like between Catholicism and Protestantism, with Dee on the one side and Debdale, am I saying his name right? Debdale?
Mm-hmm.
And Debdale on the second, on the side of Catholicism. So for Shakespeare, what are the stakes and how much danger is Shakespeare in joining the side he's actually spying against?
That's a great, great question, and one I've not answered sufficiently in your other questions. One of the differences, well, maybe not, but the way I see it, one of the differences between our time and that time was that everyone believed in heaven. Well, not everyone. Marlowe didn't believe in heaven, but most everybody believed in heaven, and their soul was always at risk. And they didn't always live their lives accordingly, but they gave lip service to the fact that they should live their lives accordingly. And there was a huge, horrible debate between Catholicism and Protestantism at this time, all over Europe, including England. And so if you believed in one over the other, there was the great threat when you were on your deathbed, would heaven decree you a heretic because you had believed in one over the other? The Protestants swore that if you believed in Catholicism, you would go to hell. The Catholics believed if you believed in, The Protestants believed that if you believed in Catholicism, you would go to hell. The Catholics believed that if you believed in Protestantism, you would go to hell. So either way, you might go to hell. And they believed in hell. I would venture to say more people today believe in heaven than they do in hell, but it was equal to the Elizabethan mind. So an eternity in hell was what you faced if you got it wrong. And nobody knew, I mean, both were advocating, both were had strong advocates. And most of the people just didn't know, or they just left it alone. They just left it alone. So yes, it was a great risk for Shakespeare as a young man, as any young man dealing with great issues is caught up in a turbulence between what to believe. And Shakespeare, having been brought up a Catholic, but is now a resident of London, where it's primarily Protestants, he's being buffeted by these policies, and you know, he's on this island that is primarily Catholic, and yet his mentor is primarily Protestant. So he's caught between a rock and a hard place, and he has to work it out. I don't know if he ever successfully works it out, because as I told you, no one knows historically where Shakespeare stood on this issue, and it was a huge issue. There were very few issues that were as huge as this was in Elizabethan times.
Now, as a question of how of the reasoning behind the issue, is the issue in reality one of faith, or is it of power? Because obviously the issue is the Catholic Church trying to gain influence into England, and then you have Queen Elizabeth who's trying to maintain her own power structure. So functionally, is it more of a power struggle, or is it true faith for the ones who are involved right now?
It's both. It's both. It's a matter of faith for many of the people at the top, the archbishops, the bishops, a lot of the priests. Well, there wouldn't be priests; it'd be vicars. They believed in Protestantism in their heart and soul, and they were trying to convince their congregants to do the same. And the Catholics from Rome on down, they believed in their ways. So it was very much a matter of faith for those people and for many, you know, lay people in England and Europe. However, the Elizabethan government was always terrified that a Catholic fervor would rise up and destroy the Elizabethan government. So that's a political thing. This is not about faith. This is about politics. This is about people rising up against what they think is an unjust policy. So they were worried about Catholics, not so much, the government was not worried about Catholics and their faith. They were concerned about what their faith would incite them to. Mm-hmm. So it's both faith and politics at the same time.
So for people like me, I'm a Jew, so I don't really know the details of all this. Between a Protestant and the Catholics, once again, for hell to be at stake, what is so fundamentally different that if what seems out from the outside as being pretty much the same damn thing, to think that one is damning to a soul over the other?
Also being Jewish, you're right. It seems like very small difference. But those small differences were important to those people. I'll give you a couple of examples. For one thing, the Catholic faith believes that Jesus is present in the host, that his presence is actually there in the host. And when you celebrate Mass and you are given the host, you are indeed communicating, eating Jesus. The Protestants didn't believe in that, thought that was hooey. The Protestants didn't believe that the vicar of Rome, the Pope, was the head of the church. And they believe Catholicism is a hierarchical, and forgive me if I'm getting this wrong, but I think I'm right, is a hierarchical religion in the sense that power starts at the top from the Pope and works its way down through the archbishops, the bishops, the priests, the vicars, everybody on the way down. The Protestants believe, no, it's about community and that each community is unto itself. Mm. Other thing is, which I've always been interested in, is that Catholicism at that time readily believed that when you died, your soul went immediately to one of three places, heaven, purgatory, or hell. The Protestants believed that there was no purgatory. And furthermore, they also believed you didn't go immediately. You went when the judgment day came. And then you were deemed either fit for hell or fit for heaven. But there were a lot of different things. A lot of the garments that the Catholic priests wore were laughed at by Protestants. There were many little things, niggling things. I call them niggling. To them, there wasn't niggling at all. That made a difference. And these things, believing in them or not believing in them, made the difference of your soul, mm-hmm. your very soul. And those people who thought about this were very, very concerned about their souls and their family souls and their friends' souls, and they would fight to the death. For instance, in our own time, and I'm not knowledgeable about this at all, and I should, and I'm not, but we watch what was happening in Iraq. We have two Muslim communities, or Arabic communities. I'm using the wrong terms here, I think. But we have the Shia and the Sunni. They're both Muslim sects, and yet they fight each other for control because each thinks that their particular policy, their particular tenets are the right ones, and their near neighbors are the wrong ones. So this has happened all through history.
It really is fascinating from an outsider's perspective because, like I said, even the differences you gave seem so insignificant in some way that you think, why would you kill each other over this? But obviously, I mean, historically, even like you kind of about like Ireland or whatever, really not insignificant to them.
Faith and religion have always been a major cause for wars, for disagreement, for killings, and for good things as well. I don't want to not say that. But at this time, people were dying left and right over their religion. We call Elizabeth's predecessor Bloody Mary because she killed off a tremendous amount of Protestants who believed in the Protestant faith. But Elizabeth could equally be called Bloody Elizabeth. She killed off not as many as Mary, but she killed off quite a few Catholics, including one of Shakespeare's relatives, two of Shakespeare's relatives, because of their Catholic faith. We look back and we shake our heads and wonder why, but it was very prominent at that time.
Now, once again, going back to Shakespeare and his beliefs, we said it's a fight between Protestantism and Catholicism, but is it more that, or is it a fight of emotion between Debdale, who he loves, and Dee, who he's grown to love?
Well, they represent the two factions that's going on. Debdale is a committed Catholic. Dee is an outspoken Protestant. And if he's going to succeed, if Shakespeare is going to succeed as a playwright in London, he needs to espouse Protestantism. If you weren't Protestant, you weren't going to get very far. Catholics actually were rejected from lots of employment if they were Catholic advocates. So you need to at least give lip service to Protestantism. Hmm. So he is dealing with that. And as I say, I don't know whether the historical Shakespeare ever made up his mind or did make up his mind and just never told anyone. We do know for a fact that he was brought up in a Catholic household.
Is Debdale
but, but also, a lot of people, certainly the generation before Shakespeare, they were all brought up in Catholic households because everybody was Catholic then. And yet the Protestant movement inspired people to change their minds.
Now, is Debdale historically, yes. Did he live in history?
Yes, everything I say about Robert Debdale is exactly correct. That is, he was Shakespeare's compatriot, friend when they were young. Debdale, who was from a Catholic family, is forced to leave not only Stratford-upon-Avon, but also England, and lives in Europe with Catholics in order to escape the duress that the Elizabethan government has put on Catholics.
Now, there's some great scenes in the story between Dee and Debdale when they're looking over Shakespeare. Now, Dee knows that Debdale is a Catholic. Right. He's someone who Dee has been sent, or represents someone that Dee's been sent to suss out.
Right. No, he hasn't been sent to suss out Debdale. He is a Catholic, and it turns out is a slightly dangerous Catholic because of who Debdale is associated with, and becomes a key factor in the story, but it's not Debdale himself. Debdale is not responsible for allowing Catholics to stop over in Illyria. That's quite obvious to Dee.
So, but is Dee still technically responsible for revealing what Debdale's doing at all?
Yes, and I deal with that in the third book. So there's no, I understand why you don't know about that. Yes, he is responsible, and Shakespeare is concerned about that responsibility.
A quote from the book from page 69 and 70, I'm not going to read the whole quote, but the paraphrased version of it. You wrote, "Books can moderate our passions and teach us acceptance. They have the power to inspire. They give breath to enhance life's experiences." Now, is this Shakespeare or is this you saying, like giving these lines to the reader?
I think it's both. I think certainly it's me speaking first. But one of the things that Dee gives Shakespeare is access to books that he's never had before. And Shakespeare is inspired by the wisdom that he finds in these books and in the lectures that Dee gives him about these books. But certainly, perhaps the original desire to validate literature and books comes from me. Yes,
it does sound like you explain to the reader why Shakespeare's writings have survived the centuries.
Well, I don't know if I do that, but I am trying to sort of, in a weak fashion, trying to explain how this boy from the country, this rural bumpkin, became the great writer, William Shakespeare. I'm trying to indicate that that it was access to people like Dee and to books like Dee had, and I'm going to tell you a story in a second to validate that. That inspired Shakespeare to be a better writer and to have access to wisdom and knowledge that he might not have had by only going to what we would consider an elementary school in a small town in Stratford. I will tell you one of my favorite incidents that happened many years ago, trying to make it as brief as possible. I was already writing this book, and I was doing a TV show where I was playing a historical character, who famously went to major college libraries, university libraries, and stole precious books. He didn't sell them, he kept them. And he wanted them only for himself. And he kept them, I believe it was in Ames, Iowa. I believe that's where he had them all. Anyway, in reading that book, they started to talk about Shakespeare's creation of the play Richard II. And there was a little footnote at the bottom of the page that the editor put in saying that there are many, Shakespeare stole most of the plots of all of his plays. There's, I think, only one play where he didn't steal the plot. So they all, if you find the original work, you can see what he used, what he didn't use. In Richard II, which was a historical play, a lot of the language can be found, according to this editor, in a French poem called Trezon. And the footnote at the bottom of the page said, but the only existing copy of Trezon in England was to be found in John Dee's library.
Oh, very cool.
So you can imagine my surprise and delight and glee when I went, oh my God, what I made up in my mind might have actually happened.
That is awesome.
that Shakespeare actually was visiting this library and reading what was there, and it was inspiring him to write plays. So, yes.
That is absolutely awesome. That's a fantastic story. So you do think maybe Shakespeare and Dee did have some sort of relationship or mentor, perhaps?
If possible. Not only is that a possibility that I just explained, but some people have said, again, take it with a grain of salt, is that the architect for the Globe Theater might have been John Dee, who was an expert at many things. And it may be, and I don't remember how they can attribute this, but they suggested that the angles of the globe might have had mystical significance. This may be hooey, but and it might be something that John Dee would have incorporated into the architecture. It is another more impressive reference. Is that many experts in Shakespeare believe that the character of Prospero in The Tempest is absolutely based on John Dee.
Oh, that is awesome.
That is accepted by many, many Shakespearean scholars.
That's awesome. It totally gives you a different way of looking at that play.
Yes. And forgive me, this is tangential, but if you realize that Prospero is a man who wants vengeance, you can see it has been kicked out of his realm, just as Dee was kicked out of many, many things in court. You can see the references. You can see hear the echoes.
That is so cool. And one other thing I want to kind of go back to, because when you said all but one of Shakespeare's plays, he borrowed from somewhere else.
Borrowed is another word.
Now, the interesting thing is in reading your novel, he performs a play with the character Galatea, and there was a Galatea play by someone named John Lyly. Did Shakespeare rip it off, or are you insinuating that Lyly ripped it off him?
No, John Lyly he came first, so Shakespeare would have ripped it off from him. Understand, at that time, plagiarism was not a sin. In fact, many playwrights, many writers would steal from others because of their wisdom. They took the wisdom that they found in those reference books and they just copied it, repeated it. And I will admit that there are several lines, many lines in my books that are ripped off from the plays. You know, I put it in dialogue, but they're just lines from the plays. And my excuse is that if they're in Shakespeare's mouth, then it's something that, you know, that he remembers and he writes down in his plays. Or if it's in Dee's mouth, it's something that Dee remembers and that Shakespeare remembers that Dee said and he puts it in his plays. But I too am borrowing from Shakespeare the way a lot of Elizabethan writers borrowed from each other.
So in the case of the play in front of Count Orsino and Countess Dion, are you insinuating that in the story that he's taken it, or was that just what you're inspired, what inspired you to add that part in it?
I was inspired. Certainly, I don't think that the Count and the Countess ever existed, not in the way that I imagine or write. And that just simply, as I said earlier, my writing is an attempt to mix history and fantasy together. It's not fantasy. There are no dragons. There's no, you know, there's nothing of that nature in it. But the fact that I'm using theatrical characters from one of Shakespeare's plays is fantastical. But I'm trying to mix that with history and with ideas in order to intrigue the reader, to enjoy the Easter eggs that are there, and at the same time, perhaps learn something about the period. And again, perhaps get an inkling of perhaps how Shakespeare became the writer he became.
So just going back a little bit, so in your opinion, so in the story, so Shakespeare and the Galatea story, is he referring to it, or like knowingly or not?
That I will leave to you. When I did that, I certainly used the Galatea story as a reference for myself. So if I am partly the voice of Shakespeare, then he is certainly referring to it.
But I do think that's one of my favorite scenes. It was done. I think my favorite scene is the Star Chamber. And then after Star Chamber, the play is my second favorite part of the story.
Well, they were very difficult. Both those were the two most difficult sections to write. Those were very hard to write. I wanted to get them right. And at the same time, I never saw a production or a mask for that matter. So I'm writing about something I don't know, which is not good. Nor was I a spectator at the Star Chamber. So again, I'm dealing with all the books that I'm reading about these things, but I have to sort of write them for myself, write them for my own. And I want to get them right. So they were both very difficult sections. I'm very flattered that those are two of your favorites.
They are definitely the ones, they just stand out because the play, it was just fascinating watching like a pseudo, not pseudo, may not be the right word, but proto Shakespeare running a play. And with this, with Cupid and everything, it had great humor. And also, like I said, you can kind of see a Shakespeare coming out in it a little bit.
Right. And I also, to some small degree, incorporated what it's like to be an actor on stage. And that, especially working with a child actor, if you're an older actor working with a child actor, it can indeed be difficult. So I'm in that case, I am writing about something I know.
Now, another character in the story that I was fascinated by, and I hope there's more of, Captain John Clinton. Now, what inspired his creation? Is he going to have more in book three to do? And does John Dee keep his word? Or, you know what, I think the part that I found was fascinating with John Dee is that he gives his word on something that he can't possibly keep his word on. There's no way in the world he can promise what he promises. But
it didn't stop people. It never has. It never has. But it certainly didn't stop people at that time. And to answer your question, yes, Clinton certainly is part of the third book.
That's fantastic. I mean, what in the hell is Dee going to do if he wasn't him, doesn't give him the go? I mean, is there a way out of this problem for him as well?
Which problem? I'm sorry, I'm not following.
The problem of Dee keeping his word to Clinton, and then something, because once again, the whole idea that Clinton is not killing Dee, because Dee has promised to basically allow him, I can't remember the word that's used, but basically allow him back into London and kind of give him a pardon for everything he's done. But that's up to Walsingham, who doesn't necessarily have to give a shit once he has the information that he needs.
Read book three.
I would like to, and I can't wait for it to come. You said January 20th, is it, huh?
January 24th, actually.
Now, one other character, that's a quick question on. There's another character you created in book one, Captain Palash.
Palash. Mm-hmm.
He's the Jewish pirate. I mentioned him a little bit in the, I think we had the first interview because I liked the character so much. And he's not in the second book, which I wish he was. Is he going to bring him back at all in the third?
Clinton comes back, Palash does.
Oh, you got to find a way to get Palash somewhere in a future book.
If you're interested in Palash, I recommend highly to you that you do research on Palash. Samuel Palash is a historical character.
And how about Clinton? I think I've seen the name.
Is also a historical character. Clinton was a buccaneer. All the things that I say that he did, he did. And we incorporate that, understand that in Twelfth Night, there are pirates. So I'm incorporating history again with fantasy. There are pirates in Twelfth Night. Not much is spoken about the pirates in Twelfth Night, but they are there. Just as Viola's brother is only mentioned once in Twelfth Night, very briefly. Viola's brother is mentioned a lot. He's a character in the play, but Olivia's brother. He's touched upon briefly once in the play, but of course, Edmund Dautrice is a huge character in the play, in the book, excuse me. And again, I was inspired by what happens in 12 Men.
Now, is Clinton loyal to Queen Elizabeth? Because it seems like it's hard to tell quite what his motivations are, but.
Well, I believe, to answer your question bluntly, he is loyal to the queen, but he's also a buccaneer. He's also we would call him a pirate, but a buccaneer. And so he's loyal to himself, but he gives more than lip service to being loyal to the queen as well. He's a good Englishman.
Now, I have one final, it might be a silly question, but I was curious when I was reading the book. So the book is designed with the chapter always starting on the right-hand side. Is that a superstitious thing or is that a publishing thing?
That's a publishing thing, which I wasn't aware of.
Yeah.
I've seen it, but I never clocked it. that is a publishing thing, and I don't know why the publisher did it. If it works, fine, but that was out of my hands.
All right, because I just noticed, because the way the book is set up, is that the chapter always starts on the right-hand side, and if the chapter before it ends on the right-hand side, there's a blank page, and then it starts again on the right-hand side.
I'm sure that's something that my publishers decided to do. They never asked me about it, and as I said, this is really the first time I'm clocking it.
Sorry, it's just one of those things that as I was reading, I was just thinking about, and then I was like, I wonder if that's like a superstitious like writing thing that I don't know about, or is that something else going on?
It may be a tradition in the publishing world, perhaps not. I mean, I don't see that happens all the time, but perhaps this particular publisher, that's a quirk of theirs.
All right, sorry, I was just curious. It might be like a nerd reader thing that I was checking about. So, the book you said comes out January 20th. What is the name of the third book? 24th. January 24th. Do we have a title for it?
Yes, Imbalance of Power. In fact, as a sneak preview, this is what it looks like.
Oh, that looks really nice. Very cool.
It's Imbalance of Power. And in fact, two things are happening even as we speak. One is there are pre-sales for this. If you go to my website, www.armandshimmerman.com, you can pre-order the book. My publishers have also taken a new angle on this. They are actually setting up a Kickstarter account that will help with the publishing of this. And you get certain perks if you contribute to the Kickstarter. Both these things are on my Twitter account, hold on just a second.
Sure.
I have it here because it was sent to me today. Now that's the pre-order. If you go to my website on www.armandshimmerman.com, you can see what I'm talking about, the Kickstarter campaign. And if you're interested, please do contribute.
Is the campaign active right now?
Yes, it started today.
Oh, hey, perfect timing. That's awesome. So what we're going to do for the listeners as well, when you look at the YouTube and the website, underneath the description notes, we'll put a link to the Kickstarter.
Great.
So
thank
people
you.
Can find it. So I'm one of those people who are looking forward to it. Like I said, I truly did love the first two, and I look forward to reading the third one as well.
Well, as anybody who does anything, I'm very proud of the first two books. Very, very proud of them. And I'm very flattered that you like them, Jeff. But as one does anything, one gets better. And I'm very proud of the first book, but I believe the second book is better than the first book. And I very much believe the third book is the best of the three, because I learned to write better. I am by profession an actor and a teacher. Writing, I love writing. I love writing, and thank you for the compliments you've given me. But it's a learning process for me. And I imagine it is for everybody. I imagine whoever you are, as you do things more and more, you get better at it. So I think the third book is really quite good, as I believe the other two are, but this is the best of the three. And I hope the people enjoy it as much as you do. Thank you, Jeff.
I hope so. And thank you so much, Mr. Sherman, for talking with me. I hope to read the third one.
You too.